Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Aloha, movie nerds. Thanks for checking out the Top 100 Project, the podcast that takes a chronological look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2000 Top 100 lists. Heads up, we are about to spoil every single frame of this flick. I'm Ryan Ellis, sitting beside the woman with whom I often frolic in the surf, my wife Bev.
That's me.
And Fox is here too, as he always is. The coming attractions trivia for this week's film, From Here to Eternity. The story takes place during World War II. What's the next AFI film to be set during World War II? And what's the last AFI chronologically to take place during that war?
Well, the last one is Saving Private Ryan.
That is correct.
And the next one is, Dr. Zhivago. I've never seen Dr.
Long
Zhivago.
Way off. If I went...
Oh!
And Fox likes that whistling.
Yeah.
Bridge and the River Kwai.
Like the dog. Yeah.
It's Bridge and the River Kwai.
Well, I was right that it was a David Lean film.
You were correct about that.
All right.
Zhivago's his last of the three. Bridge and the River Kwai is his first. The middle one is the epic Lawrence of Arabia. But today, the Top 100 Project's 46th movie is From Here to Eternity, which ranked 52nd on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between The Philadelphia Story and Amadeus. But like Amadeus, Fred Zinnemann's flick didn't crack the Top 100 in 2007, although it was nominated. Columbia premiered From Here to Eternity on August 5th, 1953. Then they unspooled it for the public nearly 2 months later on September 30th. This movie busted some blocks and was one of the biggest hits of the 1950s. People just love to watch Hawaiian sneak attacks. And on that note, Bev will tell us what it's all about.
Montgomery Clift is Pruitt, a new arrival at a military base in Hawaii in 1941 who doesn't want a box on his unit's team. The company commander and others try to bully him into changing his mind. Meanwhile, Burt Lancaster is the tough but fair Sergeant Warden, who begins an affair with the captain's wife Karen, played by Deborah Carr. Frank Sinatra is Maggio, Pruitt's ne'er-do-well buddy, and Donna Reed is Prue's special lady. And then, Pearl Harbor!
Special lady. She's my special lady friend, man. So in a nutshell, brawny sergeant bangs boss's bride, then fights foreign fragging.
I have a nutshell too.
Oh, hit me with it.
On a day that will live in infamy, boxing championships are canceled.
That might be better than mine. I like that. So the film got 89% of critics and 85% of audiences from Rotten Tomatoes on its side, Bev. What about you?
I would recommend it. It wasn't my favorite. I'm not sad that it lost its spot on the list in 2007.
You seem to have lost some enthusiasm from when we first turned up the
player
that night.
Yes, here is the thing. I find the movie really entertaining. It's very engaging. I was definitely wrapped up in the drama as I was watching it, and I felt this great connection with these refreshingly complicated characters, and the themes reveal themselves elegantly and with artistry, but it was one of those films that the more I think about it, the more I keep kind of poking holes in it, and I find myself, as time goes on, less and less convinced of the motivations of the characters and more kind of frustrated with, well, frustrated by the performances, particularly by Burt Lancaster. I'm a little surprised that he's gotten as much praise as he has because I found him a little wooden and impenetrable. We've not too long ago watched Sweet Smell of Success where he's playing a very sinister villain. And in that movie, his wooden impenetrability, if that's a word, it is now, is definitely an asset because it makes the character more menacing and scary. But in this, I just was left wondering, why does he love Karen even though he's bothered by her past and doesn't really seem to want a wife because he's married to the army but doesn't have ambitions? And I don't know, there was like something so missing in his character, and there's these kind of revealing points in the script, say like when he's having that very obvious discussion of suicide with Pruitt when they're sitting in the middle of the road and arguing about who should be in the more vulnerable position to get hit by a car because they both consider their lives such a worthless waste.
Well, they're drunk.
They're drunk, yeah, but
and
like
so are our neighbors are making noise outside right now.
When you're drunk, you don't talk about dying. When I'm drunk, I just
think about it all the time.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no. That's a whole other podcast.
Let me give you an answer for one of those things at least. His motivations, Lancaster's motivations. He is married to the army, and this is another movie that despite women characters, and some pretty good women characters, Deborah Carr and Donna Reed in particular, the men are the ones having the romance. It isn't physical. Mm. The movie does not in any way imply that these guys want to be with each other. Although, and apparently in the book, Maggio, the Sinatra character, was gay. And Montgomery Clift famously was at least a bisexual.
But the person, not the character, like the actor.
Yeah, the actor himself. Well, the studio boss, Harry Cohn, didn't want to cast Clift because he was, what was the reason again? He was gay, he can't box, and he doesn't look like a military guy. And yet Zinnemann insisted.
And he was good. I liked him quite a bit.
You liked him better than you did in A Place in the Sun, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, definitely. And I think that Deborah Carr and Donna Reed were both fantastic, and even Sinatra.
I don't think Reed was all that great.
Really? Oh, I disagree.
Well, especially compared to her performance in It's a Wonderful Life. In fact, she and Sinatra won the Oscars, Supporting Actress, Supporting Actress. I think they're both better in other AFI movies, her in Wonderful Life. Now, granted, we talked about on that podcast how she's Little Miss Perfect.
Yeah, she's so boring. Her character's so boring.
I don't think she's boring in that movie.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, now she's a hooker. They don't call her that, but she's a hooker.
But her character just has so much more depth. She's this kind of self-loathing, delusional, yet determined woman. She has so much more to her in this movie.
I just liked her more in the other movie, I guess.
Well, she's the much more likable
but character. But then Sinatra's other performance, not there's anything wrong with this one at all, but his performance in Manchurian Candidate, which we're going to cover later on this year, I think was definitely a better one. And that's also more of a lead. This is very clearly a supporting performance.
Yeah.
And they're the five main actors. There are many other people in this movie, and we'll get to them later on in the podcast.
See, to me, Lancaster is the one that stands out as kind of the weak link.
You didn't like his over-exaggerated gestures, which I wish we sometimes had video on these so I could do them now. The thumbs and the hands. One of the reasons I like Lancaster as an actor, the scene when he breaks up the fight between Maggio and Judson. Okay, there's a first trivia question. What weapons do Fatso, who is Judson, the Ernest Borgnine character, and Warden wield in the nightclub scene where they're threatening each other?
First, Maggio hits him with a stool, and then
I didn't ask about Maggio.
Judson has a switchblade.
Right.
I'm telling you more information than you, because I'm so smart. I'm over-answering your question. And then Pruitt comes back
not
with
Pruitt.
A broken bottle.
Well, there you're wrong, because it's not Pruitt.
Look,
it's Warden.
I just bragged about being smart, so obviously I'm smart.
But my point is that in that scene, that's the one where Lancaster does the pointing at somebody with that long thumb gesture, which almost harkens back to the Gable hitching a ride scene, and it happened one night.
But
and
it's then, that dramatic of a gesture.
Yeah, the way he just moves his hands. He just does that kind of stuff very well. Now, he was an acrobat and a circus performer.
Mm.
And it's funny because I was reading the trivia, and it said somewhere that this was his chance to be taken seriously in a real role. And the funny thing is, he had done some serious roles. He had done some character-type performances. They weren't just him grinning, because he had a great smile, and you didn't see a lot in this movie. He did a lot of inconsequential movies, too. But his very first performance was in The Killers. Now, he's not the lead of that film, but it's a very serious movie where, spoiler alert about The Killers, he gets killed in that movie. Anyway, I liked Lancaster a lot. I mean, the guy also did Sweet Smell of Success. You mentioned that already. I think that's a brilliant performance and a brilliant movie, and absolutely should have been an AFI, or at least could have been an AFI.
Yeah, I love that movie.
And then he did a lot of movies with Kirk Douglas. One of them was 7 Days in May. They also did Gunfight, the OK Corral. Atlantic City was when he got to be an older guy with Susan Sarandon. I talked about that with you during the film, and he was a different kind of actor at that point, more laid back. And then his last flick was The Immortal Field of Dreams. That's a pretty good roster of movies, I would say.
Yeah, I was actually looking up his IMDb earlier, and he's got lots of great films on that list.
He won his only Oscar for Elmer Gantry. He was nominated quite a few other times, including for this film. It's actually a pretty famous story that one of the reasons that William Holden, who won the Oscar in 1953 for Stalag 17, a Billy Wilder film, which is not on the list, the only thing he did when he went up to the podium to accept the Oscar was say, "Thank you," and walk off. And I've now read that the reason why he did that was he thought that either Clift or Lancaster should have won for this film.
So he just never prepared a speech at all?
I guess that was the idea. Maybe he thought they would win, or maybe he was angry that he did win. But the funny thing is, Holden was great in other films. You didn't like him as much in Sunset Boulevard as I did. We're going to see him in The Bridge and the River Kwai, which we just mentioned at the top of the podcast. But that's one of the things about this film I find interesting, is the Lancaster-Clift combination. You didn't say it in The Skinny, but they really are friends, probably more so than Pruitt is even with Maggio, because the Maggio friendship is such a short one. Maggio's in the stockade for so much of the movie.
They're kind of kindred spirits, because they both are self-destructive and married to the army.
Right, and the reason I want to compare them as actors is because Clift, even though he didn't call himself a method actor, we talked about that on A Place in the Sun, he kind of was. He certainly was in that same group of people. He was compared to them, whether or not he wanted to be, the James Dean, Marlon Brando, Paul Newman group of actors who were coming along at that time. And even though Lancaster only started a few years before Clift did, he seems like more that old school thing. And even Sinatra, who hadn't been in the business all that long, and the women as well, who had been in the business probably longer than all the rest of the guys, they just seem more of that old school kind of style of acting compared to this new style. So it was not intentionally a clash of acting styles the way it was when Clift worked with John Wayne in Red River. But I found that to be an interesting dynamic too.
I felt like those two had more chemistry than anyone else together.
Oh, for sure.
In the film. I really love that scene, actually, of them drunk, sitting in the middle of the road, kind of just talking about their blatant suicidal tendencies and self-loathing.
The story goes that Cliff was actually drunk in that scene, but Lancaster was playing it drunk. And I thought he played pretty well, considering he wasn't actually. And then I guess Cliff able to even get through the scene when he's drunk is a pretty
impressive thing. It's funny because when we were watching, I was thinking, wow, he plays such a convincing drunk. Yeah. Maybe he was actually drunk.
Now, as far as the story goes, with what Pruitt is going for, Robert E. Lee Pruitt. What a ridiculous name that is.
It is ridiculous. And they constantly refer to him as Robert E. Lee. It's not like
Bob Pruitt or Robert Pruitt. If they ever call him anything by then just Private Pruitt or just his last name, then yeah, it's
Or Prue, they call him Prue.
Well, it's his short nickname, yeah. Mm-hmm. But here you got a great example of the old thing of breaking a soldier down before you build him back up. Because you get the feeling that if he'd accepted the captain's original offer rather than him trying to force him to be on the boxing team, he would have been the star. He would have been treated like he was golden.
Well, the other boxers were treated golden, right?
But him in particular, because he would have been the best one by the way
it's But he implied. Already left his old regiment because they gave somebody his job, even though they didn't deserve it, as the bugler.
Yeah, he's also a bugler too. Yeah.
He has to be the best at everything. This is another thing that I picked apart when I was thinking about the movie. I'm like, does he have to be the best boxer and the best bugler and the best pool player and the best punishment endurer?
But the treatment, as they call it. Yes, the treatment.
But he is a terrible murderer. He's very bad at murdering people. I mean, he's good at achieving murder, but he's bad at getting away with it and not getting hurt in the process.
Well, he is facing a guy who's bigger than he is. He probably should have handed his behind to him.
He's amazing at everything else.
Of course, what we're referring to there, and you should already know the movie, you should have seen the movie, but he does kill Fatso, who's...
Yes.
He and Maggio, Ernest Borgnine and Frank Sinatra's characters, are always looking for trouble.
Yeah.
They spend the movie most of the time either being drunk or, in the case of Maggio, getting in trouble for some reason.
Yeah, it's kind of... That's another frustrating thing about it is I assume that it was just for the sake of moving the plot forward and giving Prue an excuse to go kill this guy and get into the trouble that ultimately is the end of him. But Maggio, like, all you have to do is show up for work. That's all you have to do. If you get thrown to the stockade, you know this guy's going to make your life absolute hell. Don't do it. When he shows up drunk, you're just like, come on! Who would be that stupid?
Well, because he leaves
his post.
His post. It goes AWOL.
Yeah.
The army does not handle that very well. I mean, even Prue is saying, you're going to get in trouble, but also he's trying to get him back there to face the music because he knows that this isn't cool even with me, man, let alone with the people in charge.
The biggest mistake Maggio ever made was accepting a position in an institution that puts you in prison for not showing up for work. Fatso actually says it to him. If I know guys like you at all, you all end up in the stockade sometime.
Yeah. Maybe Maggio's self-destructiveness puts him in that position of needing to be beat up, needing to be
killed. Love to be punished. That's definitely a recurring theme in the film is this self-destruction, this self-loathing, this desire for punishment. Because even as Prue is getting the treatment, as you call it, as they call it in the film, which is basically they're bullying him into accepting a role on the boxing
team. And then the punishments he gets forever.
Yeah, but he seems to like it. People keep telling him, like, why are you putting up with this? Why don't you just give in? And he's like, it's all right. He just seems to accept it with such stoicism that you believe, because I trust his performance, I trust that he's a good enough actor to convey this properly. I believe that part of him is happy to be punished because he's so mad at himself for hurting his friend because he blinded his friend in a sparring match. And that's why he refuses to box. And I think he sees this as his punishment for hurting his friend.
Well, it's also that he wants to be in the army. He makes it very clear. Mm-hmm. He has no intention of not wanting to be part of the group. It's just that he wants to do it on his own terms. Man got to go his own way or he's nothing, which is really not the way that the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or Marines have ever looked at it. Sorry to say, but I don't know much about, obviously don't know anything about being in the military, but if I ever just had to be in the military, I would accept the fact I can't just be Ryan. I got to be part of the group.
And it's also kind of the irony that he's a pacifist. He doesn't want to fight. You're in the Army.
Yeah.
Your job is eventually probably going to be killing people. There's a war going on. It wasn't peacetime. It's not like you could just suspect that you're going to join the army and probably never have to kill somebody. No, he's talking about how he's a 30-year man and there's a massive war waging.
America's not in it yet, but
but I'm sure that for a long time. They considered it a pretty strong possibility they were eventually going to have to fight.
Never once mentioned, though, in the whole movie, as I recall, that there's a war going on.
No, it doesn't really come up very much.
Because they're in Hawaii, although they're in paradise and not really getting to enjoy the paradise part of Hawaii all that much. But they don't really ever mention the fact that this is happening in the world.
Yeah, I wonder if being stationed in Hawaii was probably considered kind of an easy job. They never expected
May have
Japan
been.
to attack them. I mean, everyone talks about what a surprise Pearl Harbor was. Those soldiers probably felt perfectly safe. It would be like a soldier being stationed in Germany now. Well, I'm never going to see action. I'm in Germany. That's
Yeah.
probably how they felt over in
That's maybe why
Hawaii.
the Japanese decided to do it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get back to what you just talked about when it comes to the Maggio and Pruitt self-inflicted punishment, if you want to call it that. And you mentioned off the top about Lancaster, the issues you had with him. The other thing I could say in defense of him, in defense of the character, is that maybe he's doing the same thing. He goes after his boss's wife. How is that ever going to work out? And then the irony of Karen. She claims to love him, but she ditches him when he doesn't want to be promoted. He wants to stay doing what he's doing, but it's not good enough for her. His position of being a sergeant doesn't want to be an officer. And the man that she's married to, Captain Holmes, only wants to be promoted, yet she doesn't love him. I'm not criticizing her character, but I'm saying that Warden goes after her for reasons unknown. He's not with her before the movie starts.
No.
He goes after, and it's almost like when Pruitt comes in, everything gets ignited. Maggio, who had been part of the group, and maybe he'd been treated badly or punished before, but now suddenly he's always getting in the middle of everything and sticking his nose where it doesn't belong and gets punished more than anyone else does, really. Probably even more than Pruitt does, and Pruitt certainly gets punished plenty. But Warden is probably doing this also because he has no respect for his boss. He does his boss's
Yeah.
job for him, which many people, I'm sure, in this situation and every job in the world have a feeling like, well, I'm doing the
Yeah.
boss's job more than they
And
are.
his boss is corrupt as well.
Right, and his boss is a terrible person, of course. His
Yeah.
boss is not a good man. Maybe that's why he goes out of his way to destroy himself almost. Although
But
he, in the end, he's the one character that's actually still doing what he was doing and seems to be
yeah, he
relatively
makes
happy,
out all right
Warden.
in the end. But he, yeah, definitely self-destructive. He mentions at one point he's facing 20 years in the stockade for fraternizing with an officer's wife. There's real stakes with them keeping their affair secret.
Let's talk about that. That's one of the most famous shots of film history.
Yeah, you know, we talked about when we watched Singing in the Rain about the infamous shot of him swinging on the lamppost. Definitely hand in hand with that shot is Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster on the beach with the water washing over them as they make out.
And apparently that part of it, them laying down in the surf and having it crash around them, that was an improv by Fred Zinnemann on the day.
They had to fight for it with the censors. The censors wanted them to stay standing.
Yeah, because it is pretty sexy. The movie actually had censor problems going in, but they had to cut a lot of the sex. I mean, there's no sex in that scene, but it's certainly implied that that's what's going to happen that day. And most of the violence, I mean, there's definitely some violence, but it's not as violent as what is apparently in the book. And of
They're
course,
also somewhat cagey about the Congress Club.
yeah, it's clearly supposed to be a
It's a
whorehouse,
whorehouse,
but they don't
like
call it that, yeah.
yeah, she's a prostitute.
And then they had to cut out, of course, was all the language. They didn't have any bad language because it's still 1953 in movies. You're not going to have any four-letter words. And that bothered the author, James Jones. But back to the scene. I bet most people who know about that scene don't remember that they get into an argument 1 minute later
Yeah, that
about who she
surprised
slept
me.
with.
Yeah, because I'd never seen the movie before, but I've seen, of course, that shot 100 times, and it's so sensuous, and you assume that the next thing they're going to do is whisper to each other and make promises,
Well,
and have
after
nothing
that
but
shot,
passion.
though, she runs off to their
The
towel,
blanket,
but
yeah.
away from the water, and he runs after her, collapses on his knees in the sand, and then envelops her in this great big kiss and the big
Yeah.
brawny Burt Lancaster. So that actually is probably even more hot than the shot in
Yeah,
the
and
surf.
it is kind of hot.
But yeah, less than a minute later, they're arguing,
Yeah.
angrily arguing.
Yeah, but that's like kind of another dichotomy of that character. What are you doing with this woman if you're disgusted by her behavior? Because
He knew going in that she had been
he
accused of
knew
these
they
things.
talked about that before he ever got involved with her, that he wasn't the first person that she cheated on her husband with.
And she explains later that she had problems with the husband, largely because he bailed on her when she had a baby on the way and she had, what was it, had an
She
abortion or
was
had
having
a
no, she was having a
miscarriage.
miscarriage, which
Right.
I also take issue with. He came home drunk and she begged him to call the doctor and then he just passed out drunk. And I say to you this. Can this woman not operate a telephone? Is it that hard to dial a number and
Maybe
call the
she was
doctor
that
yourself?
incapacitated. I don't know. Could be.
I don't know.
Maybe she's looking for excuses.
That just seemed like, I don't know, some convenient.
That's one of the things about the two women. We never really get scenes with them unless they're with those two men.
Until the very end.
Until it's just the two of them, exactly. And
Yeah.
even then, we don't really get a whole lot into them because Loreen lies about
Well, you
what
kind of
happened.
learn a lot about Loreen in that scene,
Yep.
that she tells this brazen lie. And then you wonder about everything that she said and
And then
everything about
Karen
her
knows it's a
character.
lie because Warden would have told her all about Pruitt and that he had been injured or that he was the one that everyone thought had killed Fatso. No one had proof yet, and of course he hadn't been found because he's gone AWOL.
In a way, it's sad that Loreen doesn't get to enjoy that last beautiful lie that she tells herself as she's leaving Hawaii.
Well, Karen doesn't call her on it, I guess, so she does get
it. Yeah, that's true. That's true, I guess. It's the humiliation that she suffers without even knowing it. Not only being caught as a liar about her fiancé who went down as a fighter pilot, also the truth and how ugly that is that her not-even-fiancé was a murderer who got shot dead by...
And in the Army's terms, going AWOL is probably worse than any of those things. You're certainly on a par with it.
Talk about really illustrating the questionable ethics of the institution of the U.S. Army, that you get imprisoned for 6 months for going AWOL one night, yet if that guard beats you nearly to death every day...
He's punished, but probably not for 6 months.
Yeah, yeah, never. He's never going to get put in the stockade.
Apparently one thing that's in the book, then this bothered Jones as well, they took out that the captain is promoted. In the movie, he has to resign. And that's one of those moralistic things in movies back in that day. You couldn't let someone like that get away with.
Yeah, and when we were watching the movie, and there's that scene where they're asking him to resign or face court-martial, that would never happen. There's no way the Army would ask an officer for their resignation because he bullied a private. And that's when you told me then that, well, they had to put that in. And it wasn't just the censors. It was because the Army itself needed to approve the script because they were shooting on the actual barracks in Hawaii. The Army insisted that they got to kind of have a look at the script, and they insisted that they change that.
Agreed. Now, I want to say one more thing. Before we get off this whole talk about the ending and what happened with Prue, it is one of the lamest deaths in movie history.
It's just so unnecessary. Because
he wants to go back to his base so badly and wants to be part of things, even though he's bleeding from his gut. Maybe, I mean, I guess they could fix him up and he'd be useful. And as he says to Loreen, he's going to be useful because every man's going to be needed. They'll be letting people out of the brig to fight now that, that the Pearl Harbor attack has happened. But he's skulking around. And again, just like in Shane, kind of a bad day for night
shot. Oh, yeah, this was in fact, terrible this was worse, for night. Yeah, this was really bad.
Fred Zinnemann's a good technical director, and he did High Noon, which was, of course, obviously in the span of one morning, early afternoon, no nighttime at all. But like everybody who did day for night back then, it doesn't look very convincing. But he's supposed to be doing this in the middle of the night, and he gets shot down. If you want to go back to fight with your people, and you're willing to face the consequences of maybe being punished for what you did, then just, it's me, hello!
I know, why wouldn't you just announce who you were? They're asking you to identify yourself. Identify yourself. Yeah. Whatever they're going to do to you is exactly what they would do to you when you got to the barracks. Mm-hmm. So why are you being cagey about it? They have guns on you, stupid. But, of course, this goes back to the whole self-destruction. He was suicidal. They're all kind of suicidal. And why would you join the Army? There's this theme that maybe you become a soldier because part of you wants to kill, but also part of you wants to die.
I never thought of it like that before. The killing people thing, I can believe that a lot of people do it for that reason.
Sure.
But being killed?
He's a pacifist, right? He doesn't want to kill. He doesn't even want to box. But he does want to die.
Now, by the way, there's a trivia question for you. What is the name of the friend Pruitt blinded in his boxing days?
Oh, shoot. He had a silly name like Smokey or Chewy or something, didn't he?
I like those better. We'll call him... His last name is Wells. Let's go with Chewy Wells.
Was it something stupid like that?
It was Dixie Wells.
It was stupid.
Presumably also from the South. Dixie and Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, oh yeah. I have a trivia question for you. What was Loreen's real name?
I thought I wrote that down, but I don't recall now.
It's Alma!
Right. Well, we talked about Lancaster and Cliff's credits already, but I'll say a little bit more about Monty. He made only 17 movies. Now, we may have mentioned them on A Place in the Sun. He also did Red River and Judgment at Nuremberg, including, of course, these two. But this is the last time we'll see him on the AFI list. It wasn't too long after this. I forget what year it was. He had his infamous accident. He was leaving Elizabeth Taylor's house and was never the same. His face was pretty much destroyed. Although I've seen his movies since then. It's not like he looked like the Elephant Man or anything.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I don't think he was ever that handsome.
Well, I think you're wrong.
I know you have the odds for him.
He's a handsome fellow. He's
just not my type. Ugh, he's very pointy. He has a very pointy face. If he had not gone in a car accident, maybe he would have aged to become John Slattery.
That'd be all
right. Yeah, that's right. You I like also John like Slattery, too. You like pointy-faced men.
He's the best part of Mad Men a lot of the
time. Oh, well, I didn't say he wasn't charming.
As for Clifton Lancaster's female co-star, Deborah Carr, this is her only AFI-er. She's a Scottish actress, if you didn't know that.
I didn't?
And she was cast against type in this film. Apparently, a lot of other people could have had it. I mean, we're probably going to say that on every podcast. This person's going to play the role. That person's going to play the role. But this one could have been Joan Crawford. And I think they got lucky here. Mm-hmm. Crawford's a little too tough, a little too hard, a little too mean, I think, to play the Karen character. But Carr also is in The King and I and The Innocents. Those are her two other famous credits, I would say. And then, of course, the infamous supporting cast. Actually, there's a lot of names we've not mentioned yet after the Sinatras and Reeds of the world. Sinatra's going to be in Manchurian Candidate later this summer. He also did The Man with the Golden Arm, not The Man with the Golden Gun. Guys and Dolls, The Ocean's 11, the original Ocean's 11 movie. And then his last movie was Cannonball Run 2. He did plenty of other good films, but the reason I mention those is this interesting dichotomy of roles he did. Movies he did, I should say.
Yeah, he wasn't worried about the legacy, I suppose.
Well, he has plenty of good films in his resume.
And then Cannonball Run 2.
And that's true. Everybody does it once in a while. And Donna Reed is in her second AFI after It's Wonderful Life. She also did her own TV show and was Miss Ellie on Dallas. And Ernest Borgnine was Fatso Judson. Trivia question number 3 from my end, at least. You've given me one I didn't get. We talked about first names. What is Fatso's real first name?
Oh, gosh. Jordan.
James.
Oh, I knew it started with a J.
Jimmy Judd. But Ernie acted for more than 60 years. He was also in Marty 2 years after this, a movie that was produced by Burt Lancaster's production company. And Borgnine won the Oscar for that. He was in The Dirty Dozen, The Poseidon Adventure, Escape from New York, and another AFI-er, The Wild Bunch, which we'll be covering later on this year. Small role for Jack Warden. Very good character actors in a lot of really good movies. He's in Being There and The Verdict. And then his two other AFI-ers after this were 12 Angry Men and All the President's Men.
Which character did he play in this film?
He was Corporal Buckley. He's one of the ones that Pruitt talks to in the barracks every once in a while.
Okay.
And he's involved in the Pearl Harbor scenes, too.
Is he one of the musicians?
I don't believe he's one of those scenes,
I just briefly mentioned that was maybe my favorite part of the film. I really, really
the
love
Realism
those little...
The Realism Blues?
Oh, I love that song. I love those little musical interludes. They were the perfect length and, yeah, I love little musical interludes.
They were
interludes.
Fun.
Yeah, I like
it. And they reprised it a few different times because Lancaster sings it when he's drunk later on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's the two separate, one with a full bugle and then one with just the mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I liked it.
I did too. Now, Philip Ober, he played nasty Captain Holmes. He's also going to be in North by Northwest for us later this year, and he did lots of TV shows. And here's a guy that's pretty famous from this movie, even though he's barely in it. And the reason he's pretty famous is because it's George Reeves. He'd also been in Gone with the Wind in a small role. And the urban legend is that they trimmed his role in this one down because audiences could only imagine him as TV Superman, because that's exactly who he played the same time this movie was made.
But Zinnemann denies it.
Yeah. Well, apparently that's not even true, that the scenes they shot are in the movie. I don't know what the truth is. I'll go with that. But the Ben Affleck movie, Hollywoodland, makes a point of that, as if that was true. Audiences in that movie are laughing during an early preview, and then Affleck playing George Reeves is embarrassed. Oh, my career's over.
Except for the part of your career where you get to play Superman on TV?
Well, he was already playing it, but he was typecast in like that.
Yeah.
Now, as for the behind-the-scenes people, we got Fred Zinnemann, and we barely talked about him in High Noon, and I felt bad about that. He also directed A Man for All Seasons and Julia. This is a guy who mixed it up and did all kinds of films. He even did musicals. He did Oklahoma.
Oh, wow.
He did quite a lot of interesting movies. He did The Day of the Jackal, which is a thriller where somebody's out to kill De Gaulle, I think
it's
it
like
is.
It's like a Kubrick key.
Yeah, a lot of directors really stuck with their thing. The famous thing we mentioned about John Ford a few times is, hello, my name is John Ford and I shoot westerns.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not all John Ford did, but it's certainly what he was most known for. But Zinnemann, you couldn't really say one film he did. And you're right, Kubrick was another one who mixed it up. Kubrick, the one thing he went back to more than anything else was war films.
Mm-hmm.
But Zinnemann did just about everything, like Old Stan. Now, his writer was Daniel Terradash. This is his only AFI-er. He later wrote Picnic. We mentioned that a little bit lately. A lot of people got into Picnic, which was 2 years after this. William Holden spends a lot of the movie with his shirt off.
Oh, I have to show some respect to Burt Lancaster's
athletic
body.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Maybe that's why everyone liked his performance so much. This was like way pre-Daniel Craig, so this is probably the best they had.
During the movie,
point.
We were talking that he and Robert Mitchum, I guess, are two of the better examples of 50s bodies, because they're not cut to death.
He's like
but
a perfect triangle, his body.
That's
it's
the
crazy.
Circus performer in him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Whenever he did action movies where he had a lot of jumping and leaping around, he was in a movie called The Train, directed by John Frankenheimer, who directed The Manchurian Candidate with Sinatra and other people. But whenever he did action roles, you could really see how good an athlete he was. He wasn't quite the same caliber we mentioned, but Gene Kelly and Buster Keaton and Fred Astaire were some of the best athletes in the history of the movies. Bruce Lee's another one. But actually, Lancaster, if you're going to do a top 10 or 20 of best athletic actors, Lancaster's in there somewhere, too.
I like the way he performs being in a very small bathing suit.
Yes, it is an awfully small bathing suit. In comparison, Frank Sinatra, who's a beanpole.
He's a miniature man.
Yeah.
He's so small. Whatever... I mean, Montgomery Clift is skinny, but Sinatra is just tiny.
Whatever sex appeal Sinatra will have later in his life, I think he's probably more physically appealing in The Manchurian Candidate, which is basically 10 years later.
Yeah, maybe he had to age into that size.
Because he is beefier in that movie, for sure. And then when he got even older than that, you see him in the Rat Pack scenes with Dean Martin and his buddies, and he's probably more physically appealing than he is when he's younger in this movie, because he looks so scrawny. But back to the technical people. We mentioned James Jones wrote the novel. He also wrote The Thin Red Line, which has been made a few times, including, of course, the 1998 version by Terrence Malick. Jones wasn't happy with the changes they made to his book.
His book was apparently considered unfilmable.
Well, like I said, if you're going to have a lot of four-letter words and you're going to have blatant sex scenes, if you're going to have a lot of bloody violence, you're not going to get away with that in a mm-hmm. Hollywood movie in 1953. Mm-hmm. You're probably lucky it got made at all.
So, yeah.
And people wanted, we talked about the beach scene, they wanted Deborah Carr to be wearing some kind of skirt thing instead of an actual bathing suit.
Like go swimming in a skirt?
Essentially, yeah. So yeah. They got away with not having that, at least. And he didn't write the part of that scene that everyone loves so much, so he probably should be looking at it and saying, well, at least they improved on that. And the producer, Buddy Adler, not a big name. This is his only AFI-er. He later produced Love is a Many Splendored Thing, which I believe also stars William Holden. This guy's name is coming up a lot today. And Bus Stop with Marilyn Monroe. And then he died of lung cancer when he was only 51 years old. Behind the scenes, we've got Burnett Guffey, who is a cinematographer. He did all the King's Men a few years before this. And then he later won an Oscar for Bonnie and Clyde. And there's uncredited work by Floyd Crosby, who also shot High Noon. We mentioned he was going to be doing some work on this film.
This was nominated for an Oscar for cinematography, wasn't it?
Won the Oscar for cinematography.
Even with all that Day for Night stuff, huh?
Well, it's little, just at the end. Well, it's like Shane. They only have it at the end, as I remember, when he's riding into town.
That was better than this one, though.
And that also won the Oscar for cinematography. Mm-hmm. Hey, same year. There you go. They still had it split up. They had color cinematography, and they had black and white cinematography.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
right.
The sets and costumes. All three of those categories had two different...
Oh, wow.
And yeah, the movie is in black and white, and it's still 4:3.
This is going to... I mean, this,
almost getting into color films and widescreen.
Yeah, the black and white stuff only going to start thinning out now. Do we have many more 4:3 films? Do we have any more 4:3 films?
According to the discs and according to my research, On the Waterfront is still in that format. Rear Window may have been released 1.66:1, like we said with Shane.
Yeah.
But the Blu-ray, they released in the proper aspect ratio to the way it was shot. So that's why we saw the 4:3. That's why I think I said it a few weeks ago. The Rebel Without a Cause is our first bona fide true widescreen color.
Well, the real push for Hollywood was to compete with television at this point, because by 53, televisions were starting to become pretty common in every home.
Well, and widescreen was really new at this point, too.
Well, not just widescreen, color. It's going to motivate studios to just spend the money and shoot things in Technicolor.
Yeah. The editor of the film was William Lyon. He cut a trillion westerns and then edited The Caine Mutiny and Picnic, for which he won his other Oscar, including one for this film. And the music was Morris Stoloff, who won 3 Oscars, and George Dunning. And then speaking of the Oscars, this won 8. We just had the Oscars last week.
The Best Picture winner only won three.
Yeah. Gravity, it's one of its competitors, won 7. Dallas Buyers Club won the same amount. It won 3.
Wow.
So anyway, From Here to Eternity did win Best Picture. Best Director, Fred Zinnemann. So let's keep saying his name a few more times. Fred Zinnemann. We're sorry, Fred. We didn't talk about you enough before. I feel so guilty. Supporting Actor for Sinatra. Supporting Actress for Donna Reed. The Screenplay by Tara Dash. The Editing by Lyon. The Cinematography by Guffey. And the Sound also won an Oscar, probably mostly for the Pearl Harbor scene at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. And then it had 5 other nominations for both Clifton Lancaster as Best Actor, Carr as Best Actress. Interesting, because she's not really in the movie enough to be considered Best Actress.
I guess she's just has more screen time than...
Those distinctions are weird, though. They often will put somebody in the Best Actor category who's just a bigger name.
Yeah.
Also, the movie was nominated for the costumes and the music score. It's been the National Film Registry since 2002, so it took them a while to get it in there.
Yeah, did it ever.
The only other AFI recognition, 20th. The top 100 passions.
Yeah, belongs on that list, I think.
I would say so. I could have seen it in the top 10.
Passion especially for the guys for each other.
Guys for each other, the men and their women, and for their, as I said before, for their job.
This movie probably owes a debt to The Best Years of Our Lives, because it reminded me of that film a lot, and the relationship between the men and the kind of downside of both war and being part of the army. And
but then we got to talk about influence when we get into this aspect, and war films. Pearl Harbor, as much as that movie is a pile of crap, is it influenced by this one? I guess you could certainly say that it was, because in that movie too, you got a love triangle. It's not really a love triangle in this one, but you got all these people worried about their relationships, and then Pearl Harbor happens and they all realize, oh, wait a minute, maybe something more important is happening than our love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that's definitely influenced by this film, although Pearl Harbor is also stealing from, I don't know, how many other movies, Gone with the Wind probably as well. From Here to Eternity was a TV series in the 80s and a miniseries in 1979. I guess that led into the TV series. Natalie Wood played Karen and Kim Basinger played Lorene. Nobody famous played any of the men. And I guess I got to bring this up. The Horsehead scene, The Godfather, what leads into that, of course. The offer he can't refuse, the studio boss, which is not Harry Cohn in The Godfather, and it's not Frank Sinatra, it's Johnny Fontaine. But people have often said that Mario Puzo based that as if the mob said to Harry Cohn, either you give Sinatra this role and From Here to Eternity, this great role that revived his career, which had been flagging badly,
yes,
and this revived it. He wanted the role badly, but the reason they cast him is because he was so cheap.
Yeah, he fought like crazy for the role. Mm-hmm. Whether a horse head ended up in someone's bed is definitely dubious and probably pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
But he accepted very low wage, especially compared to, I think he made $160,000 for Anchors Away.
Mm-hmm.
And then, what did he accept? $6,000?
$3,000? $8,000.
Yeah, yeah. It's like some peanuts. Ridiculously small sum. He's probably a big enough star that they could count on him for a bit of the draw of audiences. And he's truly charming. I mean, that's all he really has to do is kind of be the charming idiot, which he pulls off with aplomb.
Using what in the scene where he uses foodstuff as dice? What is it?
He uses olives, and that scene was actually his screen test. Mm-hmm. They didn't even bother shooting it again. That was his screen test, and they used it in the film.
He improv using the olives.
Which was great. It was a great little improv, and I think that's why he got the part, because he's just that charming guy that would treat olives like dice and pull it off.
Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, he was in a movie with Marlon Brando, in a musical, in fact, Guys and Dolls. This movie and the award that came out of it certainly revived him in a way that I don't know if he ever really suffered a career drawback. Again, we talked about some lousy movies he was in, but as far as being a big name, I think from this point on, he always was.
Mm-hmm.
So if nothing else, this movie influenced Sinatra's long-term career, for sure.
Yeah.
And then maybe even Lancaster did solidify him as a lead. You may not have liked him much, but then it would have been a matter of saying, okay, this guy can carry a movie in a dramatic role and a love story role.
You know, I didn't hate him by any means, but I'm really surprised at how much praise he received for this part.
And you said already you didn't think it necessarily should have been on the list at 52nd, and then you weren't unhappy with it getting knocked off altogether. Did you think if it had been 92, you would have been okay with it being on the first list?
I'm okay with it being on the list. It was a fun movie. And you know what's funny is just as we've been sitting here having this really interesting conversation about it.
We hope so.
I've been, well, interesting to me anyway, and that's what's really important. But we've been having this great conversation about it, and just that we have so much to say about this movie is totally giving me second thoughts about my opinion. We've seen movies that I've enjoyed more than this that I've had to, I guess, struggle to justify why they're interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a plain interesting movie with interesting characters to discuss their motivations and their actions and what that means about the film and about America. Maybe I'm supporting it again. Not that I'm sad that it's not on the 2007 list, but I don't begrudge its place on the 98
What's
list.
Unfortunate about the second list is that, and a plane above agrees with me, that both Sinatra films were not on the second one. And of course, The Manchurian Candidate, to me, is the better of the two. But here's a guy who's such a big name, and he's gone from it altogether. And I guess that also meant Lancaster was gone, because he only had been in From Here to Eternity. And then Cliff's movies were knocked out, come to think of it.
Hmm.
So all these people who had an impact on the business and were in this huge hit, like I said, one of the biggest hits of the 50s, one of the most rewarded films of the 50s. 8 Oscars at that point was a lot. Here's a movie that couldn't have expected to do this, and it goes out there and becomes the movie of the year for quite a long time. I mean, to me, Shane of that same year was the better of the two films. It's one thing we haven't really done that much, have we? When we've ended a year to talk about what we thought was the best film of the year. There's only two on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Shane, From Here to Eternity.
We talked about it with 39, because there were so many movies.
Yeah, we had 5 of them, yeah.
I think Shane is a better movie.
Yeah, me too.
Period, yeah.
All right, well, that was From Here to Eternity, and I've mentioned it a few times already. Up next on the Top Nerder Project is another round with Brandon and Kazan in On the Waterfront. And you've not seen that one, have you?
No, I'm looking forward to this one. This is yet another movie that I'm so embarrassed I've never
one
seen.
One of the most classic scenes in the history of film is in this one.
Classic line, certainly. I mean, everybody knows his speech.
Yeah, so let's save it for next week. The Coming Attractions Trivia 4 On the Waterfront. Which of Marlon Brando's 3 co-stars, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, and Rod Steiger, appeared in the most AFI films?
So for the answer to that, listen to next week's podcast for On the Waterfront. In the meantime, you can find lots more trivia and other fun stuff on our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. We'd love to hear what you think of From Here to Eternity and any other movie that we've covered on the project. Please give us a shout, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Three Enlistment Blues.
And cut.